Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two.
Gilmore on
a big stop.
Oh,
brother.
Lead Toledo, Artis. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead.
Hello, and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA podcast at HarvardParoxysm.com. I am Jason Mann, and Rich couldn't be with us this week, but he'll be back soon. But we have an outstanding guest. He is the author of the book Rise and Fire. Sean Furrier, welcome to the program, sir.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
And we're going to talk a little bit about... We're going to tie in a little bit of conversation, continuing our WrestleMania series on Bill Russell, talk about the ways that he helped reshape and evolve the game and how he kind of fed the Celtics and the ways they sort of shaped the game. And I'm going to talk about a little bit about, you know, your book and what you kind of found there, particularly in jump shooting and in ways that that, of course, greatly changed the game during Russell's time in the 50s and the 60s. And then some of the, you know, the players that really stand out as stylistic innovators or, you know, interesting personalities that that we found through our research that we just want to talk about. So we're going to go a lot of places, but it should be fun. So. First, maybe talk a little bit about Rise and Fire. You know, what led you to decide to write the book and some interesting things that you found?
Well, what led me to it is, I mean, first of all, just a love of basketball, lifelong love of basketball. And I think I can call it that if, you know, starting at the age of four or so that I can remember. I consider that lifelong. And it was always my favorite sport growing up, playing it in school, playing a couple years of junior college. And then when I started writing in newspapers, you know, high school games were my favorite thing to cover, college games. I mean, it's just always been my first love. And the NBA, growing up in the 80s as a Showtime Lakers fan. My dad, I grew up in Minnesota, so my dad had been a Minneapolis Lakers fan, stayed loyal when they moved to Los Angeles. So him and his brothers were big Lakers fans, and that was kind of passed on to me. So then, you know, the last 10 years or so, I'd really been wanting to write some type of basketball book. Obviously, you know, I've read a million basketball books, whether it's on teams or players or decades or leagues, ABA, NBA, whatever it is. And then finally, I came upon this idea, and, you know, this sounds kind of corny and unbelievable, but I had a dream about 5 or 6 years ago, and it was one of my normal basketball dreams that I have every week. And in the dream, I just had this thought, you know, write a book about the jump shot. And it was something I woke up, I scribbled it down, you know, my notebook next to my bed, didn't think anything of it. But as time passed and I started thinking, yeah, I've always enjoyed nonfiction books, not sports ones, but nonfiction books that take one topic and then kind of expand on a bigger history, and Salt kind of being one of the more famous ones. I just saw one this week called Hair, the history of hair in the world. So things like that, where you could just take one thing and then expand on it. And as I revisited the idea about the jump shot, it really seemed like something, as I researched it, obviously I knew some of the history of it, but not a lot. And I could just, you could really see how the game itself changed from the time it came in, starting, you know, kind of in the mid 1930s. And each passing decade, as the game was evolving, the jump shot was really a driving force behind that. And obviously today, with the dominance of the three-pointer, so as I researched it further, and I thought, you know, this could be that thing where I can write about one thing, the jump shot, but really talk a lot about basketball history. That really appealed to me. And then it was just a matter of finding, you know, a narrative that could be kind of strung together. And then along with the book throughout, for those who have read it, they'll, you know, I kind of take some detours and side trips here and there to different players, different parts of the country. But everything's kind of focused on that jump shot and how throughout basketball history, it's really been a driving force in how the game changed.
Yeah, and it's a really enjoyable book. You know, really dug into it and really enjoyed just kind of seeing the, you know, one thing that you do a nice job of is kind of tracing how basketball sort of evolved, like, in different regions of the country. I mean, you know, up until really probably the 50s, you know, the 40s or 50s, the, you know, teams weren't really playing each other that much outside of their own area. So, you know, slowly as, you know, basketball kind of grew in, you know, high schools and colleges in the 20s and 30s and into the 40s before the war, you know, there's definitely very distinct styles that are kind of developing yeah. in different regions. And then they kind of all start to come together as, you know, the nation starts to, you know, travel is easier and college basketball starts to pick up in popularity and teams are starting to travel to play each other. So I found that really fascinating.
And you know, as you were saying that, it just kind of hit me and I guess I hadn't tied it together with my book before, but in a way we kind of still have those, that idea of different styles, don't we, with, especially in the NBA, it's always, I think West Coast teams are kind of thought of these offensive teams. East Coast, the grinded out, you know, whether that dates back to the 80s with the Celtics, Lakers, and their distinct styles. But it just kind of struck me that we still kind of have these ideas about different parts of the country playing different ways, even though, like you said, back so in the 30s and 40s, when these teams from the East were never going to play a team from the West, you had very distinct styles and the regions really took pride in how they played. And when the jump shot, Hank Lucetti, who, as I write, didn't really maybe shoot a jump shot, but he had the one-hander. And when he came to the East Coast, you had all these East Coast people, establishment, saying, yeah, that's how they play ball on the West Coast. That's never going to work here. And it was just something that each part of the country kind of had their own guys who shot the jump shot, but it had not spread really at all. So each area had, you know, their jump shooter or jump shooters, but those guys didn't really know about each other. They were kind of, you know, isolated in their own parts of the country. So like I said, it took until a lot of them met when they were serving in World War II. Two of them, Kenny Sayers and Joel Foulkes, that I write about, actually played on a really, really good Marine team that won undefeated over like a year and a half. So then you kind of finally had these players coming together. And then I think as you go into the late 40s and 50s, you kind of see basketball starting to develop an overall style where obviously everyone's now going to be start shooting the jump shot and it kind of becomes a more coherent thing. But even today, 60 years later, you do kind of have those different styles.
Yeah, and you still have a lot of controversy over, like, what is a good shot in the NBA. You know, the three-pointer has really taken hold over the last 10 years, just the increase of the amount of three-point shots. Of course, three-point shot has been around for much longer than that, but that has, there's a big division in sort of the schools of not just, like, what is, you know, what is better as far as winning goes, but there's also the idea of what is more, you know, what is better for the game, what is more enjoyable to watch, what is more authentically basketball, whatever that kind of means.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, efficiency has become a big thing. And one section of the book that I really enjoyed was the guys in the late 60s, early 70s who were anything but efficient. They would shoot 45, 50 times a game. But to me, that's just as much fun as to watch as someone making 12 or 15 shots. You know, I think it's, you know, to me, the quote-unquote right way to play the game, as just a fan, I just enjoy all ways of watching the game, whether it's certainly a fast-paced game, high scoring is what I enjoy most, but it is fun to see different types, especially if they're going against each other. And I think today's game, like I said, the three-pointer, it's interesting the way the three-pointer today, the long two, you know, that's kind of the most hated shot in basketball. And it's kind of talked about in the same terms that people talked about the three-pointer when that came into the game in the 80s, whether it was the NBA or college. It was a shot that coaches, you know, the ones who didn't like the shot really disliked. They used vulgar terms to describe it. And now the only shot that kind of brings up those types of emotions is the long two. So it's really fascinating how the game has changed.
Yeah, absolutely. And you brought up Kenny Sailors and Joe Foulkes, and Kenny Sailors who just died a couple months ago. He was written a lot about, of course, because, you know, really being a trailblazer for jump shooting at the University of Wyoming, getting national attention in 1943. And then, you know, he goes to the NBA a few years later, as the NBA is its origins, really still the BAA. He and Joe Foulkes both, really have to battle to kind of gain acceptance as far as how they play. Sailors especially. I mean, Foulkes had decent amount of success at, for the Warriors, led them to a championship, and, they were a pretty top team there. He was pretty celebrated, but Sailors had a tougher time in the NBA, and it came from, entrenched ideas of that, that's just not the right way to play, and it, led to kind of him not really having necessarily much of a NBA career.
Yeah, and that's, those early guys, you look back at their stats, you can get lost in Basketball Reference just looking at some of these guys' stats, and their careers would be so short in many cases, and obviously so much played into that. The league obviously was absolutely nothing like it is today. Salaries, they could make more money, getting regular jobs. Injuries, a bad injury could end your career pretty easily back then. And I think Kenny kind of always, bothered him a little bit that he didn't have more of a career in the early NBA. And that also might have affected how, it took many decades after that before people kind of revisited his influence on the game. I think part of that was because he had such a short, he had a couple, really solid years, but nothing, like Joe did, like you said, leading the Warriors to the championship and setting, scoring 63 points in one game, which it was a record that lasted a decade, and it was finally broken when Elgin and Wilt finally came into the league. But after he said it, people were talking whether anyone could ever break this record. This, jump shooting maniac with his two hands above his head really changed the game. But it took, it took even more years, I think, for him to kind of be recognized for his influence. And unfortunately, he died very early. So these guys kind of those early years really get lost to history. And that was one thing I enjoyed about the book is hopefully, bringing some of these guys back to the forefront. And there's been a lot of other, whether it's authors or documentary guys who are doing work like that as well. And unfortunately, it seems like I think you would, probably agree with this, that unfortunately, early basketball history just isn't as relevant, I guess, as the other sports when you think about baseball history. Everyone can name guys from the 20s and 30s and 40s, even football, boxing, but basketball history really doesn't have that same influence. So hopefully, being able to write about some of these guys and us talking about them kind of gets them back into the public's view.
Yeah, wasn't entrenched in the culture at the time, so it doesn't create those same memories in as many people, and it wasn't covered as heavily and all that kind of thing. It's fun to, in your book, obviously, I think does a really nice job bringing up some names of guys that I either hadn't heard of or didn't know much about, and just giving you a sense of the progression of the game and the changes that were made and, kind of some of the exciting players that, aren't talked about all the time. So, definitely applaud you for that. So talking about, it's a few years, later in, 1956 when Bill Russell is drafted into the league, and he's already somewhat revolutionized the game as a college player. His University of San Francisco team had a 55-game winning streak and was just, considered the greatest team in college basketball history. He comes into the NBA and, people aren't sure what to make of him. He doesn't really have the ability to shoot, but clearly he's, on these teams and his incredible defense, but the way that he played defense was even more revolutionary than some of the jump shooters because, it might have been considered bad in some circles to leave your feet on offense, but it was an absolute cardinal sin to do it on defense. And Russell did that, turning the block shot into a tremendous weapon and really being the first, you know, in basketball history to do that on any kind of significant level.
Yeah. And it's, I think you can still see that influence today, because how many times will you be watching a game today? And obviously neither of us ever had the chance to watch Russell play live. You know, we can go back and watch clips and stuff, but how many times today will you see somebody block a shot and maybe send it into the fourth row or whatever, and the announcer will say, you know, Bill Russell, what made him great was he was able to block a shot but keep it in play so often and set up his team on offense. And so his influence still 50 years later, and the way he played defensively, not just the physical skills, like you said, leaving the court, but also the just the basketball genius that he had on that, on the defensive end, where obviously he was a great basketball mind on the court, but just, you know, not a little thing, I guess, but just a thing like that, where he was so well known for rejecting a shot, but also making it sure where his team would gain possession. And it's that kind of impact, I think, just speaks volumes to the way he altered the game. And you know, like I said, he did it. That's what makes, you know, you guys have talked about this, the Russell Chamberlain rivalry, so fascinating, is because you had greatest offensive force ever, greatest defensive force ever. And to have those two guys come along at the same time is just incredible.
Yeah. And you know, it was really like one thing that I've, reading several books about Russell, and Second Wind, his second autobiography written in the late 70s, is that he just really looked to kind of find the joy in the game. And he thought, you know, jumping is really fun. Like jumping is, he calls jumping high is one of the purest pleasures I know for an athlete. Like he wanted to have fun playing the game. He wanted to win, and he wanted to understand what was going on. But you know, he talked about at his high school, and this was kind of before, really, he was not a particularly good high school player. He didn't really develop his game until after high school. He kind of lucked his way into a touring all-star high school team, and would play against other all-stars from other schools, and he would just sort of or from other areas, and he would just started to, something clicked with him, and he sort of started to be able to picture what to do in his mind, able to emulate other people's moves, and realize that he could do it. And then even more so, was able to realize he could copy other people's moves and start playing defense. Being left-handed helped him out that, because he could more easily block a right-handed player's shot and get a steal and so forth. But you know, he talked about you know, we never jumped on defense. We loved to go up in the air on offense. It was more fun, and it worked. And it was sort of considered playground or Negro basketball at the time, but it was, you know, obviously it was going to very soon change the entire dimensions of the NBA, starting with when Russell would come into the league.
And you know, you talk, that word joy, I think, is a great one that you use, because a book that I read during the research for mine, called Jump for Joy by Gina Capone Tabbery, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly. It's just a great study of, it focuses on jazz and basketball, kind of focused on in the 1930s. And she writes a lot about how she writes, she has a segment on the jump shot herself, and then also talks about the unfortunate thing is that during those years, there very well might have been many black players shooting jump shots, but whether because they didn't have the media covering them, we don't know their names, but also because that was kind of the way, you know, it wasn't an anomaly for them. It was, a lot of times it was the way they played, you know, whether it was on the barnstorming tour or wherever, so they weren't thinking how strange it was. Although she does write how, you know, even the jump shot did, it could still kind of look different, and that's why nobody really knew if that's what they were shooting. But just that joy that action brought, you know, jumping off the court and to do it defensively, and to do it as not just to jump, but to have that timing that Russell had, you know, always being somehow, you know, the offense is always supposed to be one step ahead of the defense, but somehow with Russell, he always seemed to be one step ahead of the offense, even whether he was leaving his feet. So the way he was able to combine his physical skills, his mental toughness, obviously legendary, but also that passion for the game, that joy, that excitement that he brought to it, that combination is really, you know, what made him special.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, the other thing, and this kind of keys into how the Celtics helped change the game on defense, was his ability to be able to rotate and cover, for his teammates. The it was known as the Hey Bill defense of the Celtics. If, you know, a guy, if Cousy got passed off, he'd yell, "Hey Bill," and, you know, Bill would sort of cover his mistakes, just basically rotating and being able to, you know, anybody who goes to the basket, Russell's there to protect the basket. And he had, you know, extraordinary quickness and timing and intelligence, obviously understanding the game of the men, understanding the game, understanding the geometry of the game. And in rebounding, you know, considering, you know, horizontal and vertical distances, looking at how many rebounds were caught at or below the basket, which I think he said like 2/3 of them were, you know, could have really been rebounded by anybody. You didn't necessarily have to jump the highest to do it. You just had to understand the timing and where it would go. He talks about him, you know, throughout this process as he's, you know, developing after his high school career and into San Francisco with Casey Jones, of just like, you know, spending hours just, you know, thinking about it, and also, you know, talking to people who he was close to, and just kind of understanding like how he could adjust to the game, and just spending so much time, you know, not just practicing, but, you know, mentally thinking of where he could like break barriers. There's a quote from Second Wind. The accomplishments I'm proudest of are the innovations I help introduce in the way the game is played today. Block shots, active rather than passive defense, and ideas about the horizontal geometry around the basket. And it kind of sums up some of the things we've been talking about. But really, you know, the thing that, in addition to the defense, the thing that I think the Russell and the Celtics helped usher in was an incredibly faster pace of the NBA. And it was already heading toward that way when, you know, after the shot clock was introduced in 1954. But it really turned on its head once the Celtics, you know, started to use the fast break so much, which hadn't really taken hold in the program that much. And really started to ramp up the pace of the game. It just, you know, it obviously shot up monstrously, you know, from the late 50s into the early to mid 60s.
Yeah, and as I have it on my mind, I want to revisit one other idea too with Russell.
Sure.
You talk about just kind of how revolutionary he was. And in my book, there's a quote from Fog Allen. He was concerned about, in the 30s and 40s, how tall players were really taking over the game. And one thing he advocated was a taller basket to take away some of their advantage. But the memorable phrase he used was glandular goons and tall freaks.
Yes.
To describe these guys. And in his mind, the problem wasn't, you know, a player who had some skill. It was that there were so many tall guys who just were tall, and they didn't, that was their number one skill. They didn't necessarily bring anything else to the game. And then you get Russell in the, you know, mid to late 50s. He emerges, and then obviously through the 60s, and just a totally different, and Wilt as well, obviously, tall guys, but, you know, freaks in the sense that they were great basketball players as well. It's not that their number one skill was just being tall. So that's another thing that I think Russell definitely deserves a lot of credit for, as far as being just this revolutionary figure in the game. And then you talk about the pace, and it is just fascinating. Again, going, if you go back and look at the stats of team scoring in the NBA, and certainly, like you said, after the shot clock comes in, the Celtics were the first team to average over 100 after that. And then it just keeps steadily going up and up until there's one season in the early 60s. I think there were like three or four teams that averaged over 120, you know, in an 8-team league, and it just skyrocketed. And the great thing about the Celtics, of course, was that they were able to play that style. Again, I remember in the 80s, if a team took the ball out of the basket after the opponent made a hoop and threw it down court and had a fast break, which the Lakers and Celtics both did very well in the 80s, they would always talk about Russell's Celtics and how good they were at scoring after an opponent's basket. So they had the offensive pace, but of course what made them so good, even though there were a couple times they led the league in scoring, but even if they were second or third, is the fact that their defense was so far ahead of their time in that era, where obviously they were giving up what now would be considered a lot of points, but some of those years it would be 5 points per game, you know, less than the next best team. And so that combination they had of amazing offense, great pace, the famous Celtics fast break, ignited by Russell's blocks and rebounds, but then you with Havlicek, Sam Jones, all the guys on offense, that combination is, I mean, there's a reason they won as much as they did.
Yeah, absolutely. And between 57 teams averaged 99.6 points per game and a 38% from the field. In 62, that went to 119.8 points per game, so almost 120, and 42.6% from the field. So, you know, that's a dramatic increase in both areas. And yeah, I mean, the shooters were also getting better. The jump shot was helping. You know, you could make a jump shot more easily than a set shot because it was harder to block. And so people were understanding at least a little bit, you know, what were better shots, and that was helping, you know, lead kind of the offensive revolution as well. Although I do think it was more of a pace revolution than a more efficient offense revolution. But obviously the field goal percentages certainly were making the game more enjoyable to watch, I imagine.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and there was go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, there was a lot of angst about the changes to the game. And you do a nice job of bringing that up several times in your book, where just kind of the reaction to how, people at the time felt like the game was being destroyed by these changes. And yet, of course, not now we look at that and think it's silly, but there are just so many times where... where there's like a fear of things. There's one quote from writer John McAfee in 62 where his feeling for basketball has faded almost to nothing. The game seemed to me to have lost its balance as players became taller and more powerful with few patterns of attack and almost no defense. The players, in a sense, had gotten better than the game by taking the skill out of basketball. And there's a lot of things of like, a lot of issues with the jump shot of like, okay, one guy can now, you know, basically create his own shot. There's no, you know, it loses the whole, you know, the give and goes and, you know, the passing and moving to be able to kind of get the better shot. And we see kind of some of those arguments in different forms today.
Yeah. And one of the guys I quote in my book, Jimmy Breslin, famous New York City newspaper writer in his later life, but then was a young sports writer, and he wrote that the jump shot is ruining basketball. It's these guys shoot like they're coming out of a laboratory. And one of his colleagues wrote a very similar column, and this was in the late 50s. Offense had increased tremendously, and they thought it was too easy, and it just made the game look too easy. And that, you quote, the patterned offenses, that's an interesting one because that was a concern of those guys a few years earlier too, that you no longer had these intricate offenses that had weaves and constant passing. One guy now could just rise above everyone and knock it in. And it is, you mentioned on Twitter how every 10 years or so basketball is always being ruined, and fortunately it keeps going and keeps going very well. But it's just fascinating when I was going back and finding some of those old quotes, including maybe the most surprising one to me was Bob Cousy lamenting at the time of his retirement, a month before he retired in 63, that the jump shot was the worst thing to happen to basketball in the past 10 years. And his comment was he didn't like that guys went in the air and made a lot of mistakes. He thought they were better on the ground. But it was still very weird hearing it from him, this, you know, passing, ball-handling wizard, who also played with Bill Sharman, one of the great jump shooters who helped him win several titles. So it was really interesting reading these old quotes from guys. But like you said, it's easy for us to look back and say, well, what are they talking about? But when you think about how we're having those arguments today, in 50 years, people might be looking back at our arguments and saying, well, you know, what were they talking about? So you really have to remember what, you know, what the time was and how the game was changing back then.
Sure, absolutely. And yeah, I guess maybe the reason Kuzi didn't like jump shooters is because he couldn't shoot. It would be,
yeah,
one of my guesses. But yes, but yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, bringing up Charmin, I mean, he really is. He's kind of the forgotten awesome player in that Celtics dynasty. I mean, you know, obviously Russell celebrated. And Kuzi is celebrated, but I mean, Charmin really was a guy who carried kind of the best shooter of his day, was just an incredible shooting guard who just, you know, fought around screens and, you know, would get open shots and was just, you know, it was a trailblazer in physical fitness. And, you know, some of the quotes about him, Jack McMahon of the Hawks, who faced him in the 57 and 58 finals, basically said, you know, he never lets up for a second. Never mind about the shooting. How about his guts? He's a great competitor, as great as I've ever seen. It's from Rise of a Dynasty by Bill Reynolds. And also, Charmin, you didn't really like the whole, like, denigrating of the idea of a shooter. Like, a quote of his is, "I'm a shooter. A shooter is paid to shoot. He helps his team by shooting," and then compares himself next to Russell and then says, "Does he say to one of us, I'll take this rebound and you take the next?" So just kind of the idea of, like, hey, I shoot because that's what I do in this, you know, this Celtics machine, where it's kind of, you know, all these different parts working together to, you know, make the engine run smoothly.
Yeah, that quote you just read was one of my favorites that I found from him, and one of the favorites in the whole book, really, because it really does give, you know, that power to shooters, that they have that. This is a great skill to have, and that you're really hurting the team in a way. You're not utilizing that skill. And the way he compared it to Russell's role on the team, which again is also what made the Celtics so good, is that they had each player was so good in what they did while not being concerned about stats necessarily. I don't think Russell, you know, cared if he got 40 rebounds, but he did get 40 rebounds. And Charmin, I don't think, cared that he averaged 20, but that's what he did, because each guy just knew what they had to do, and his role was to shoot. And it was really fun reading stories too about, you know, after he retired as a player and became a coach, he was definitely regarded as this very gentlemanly figure in the game. After he passed away, he had all these stories about all these letters he wrote. And when I visited the Hall of Fame and looked through his file, they had several handwritten letters that he had written to the Hall of Fame, just the sweetest, you know, notes to people, thanking them for something. But then you read these quotes of when he played, and he was a very, very competitive guy, and he got into several fist fights, which was, you know, much more common back then, of course, but right. He would challenge big guys, little guys, very competitive. And I think that also, of course, helped him fit in perfectly with that era of Celtics.
Yeah, yeah. One story that I like about regarding Russell is and turning the block shot into an accepted part of the NBA was just like early on in his first season. You know, he joins about a third of the way into the season after playing the Olympics, and he's facing up against Neil Johnston, who is like this. He's actually really effective player for Philly, who had won the championship in 56, the previous season. Yeah. So they were a standout team. They also had Paul Arizin and a good team, but you know, he was slower. He was less athletic. And you know, basically just, you know, with Russell going up against him and it just being such a complete domination of Russell, just completely blocking shot after shot against him and just almost like destroying his confidence completely. And it just, you know, it just stands out as heralding of what, okay, this is what the old big man did, and this is what the new big man is going to do. And just, you know, it couldn't hardly be any more starker than than that illustration very, very soon into Russell's career would be.
And I just think of, I mentioned my dad and his brothers were big Lakers fans, and when I was a kid and I, you know, asked my dad about those old Celtics Lakers series in the 60s, and he still, you know, that was 15, 20 years later, would be lamenting, you know, Elgin Baylor was his idol, and then obviously they had Jerry Weston too, and those two of the all-time greats. But he'd still be shaking his head in the 80s about, you know, Lakers at center, just there was nothing. They had no one that could compare to Russell, and he would, you know, name some of the names that they had, and it was like they were playing a completely different sport at that time, until obviously the Lakers got Chamberlain. But before that, it was just Russell was so ahead of the game, especially against when they would face the Lakers in the finals, that even 20 years later, it was still bothering Lakers fans. I can testify to that.
Absolutely. You know, when you brought up the 80s, there's one thing I wanted to mention that I thought was interesting is, you know, of course, the Celtics turning up the pace was a winning strategy at that point. And then in the 80s as well, the Celtics and the Lakers were both running teams. But at some point, like, running kind of became like a bad strategic thing. Like, team, you know, the game obviously slowed down quite a bit, and the teams that were playing the slowest started to win a lot in the 90s and 2000. And it's interesting because I remember there's a quote from Bird. This is maybe 87, 88-ish, or, you know, kind of after the peak of the dynasty, but they're still, you know, incredibly relevant, talking about, like, hey, you know, we need to get out there and run. Like, you know, teams that are good run and play hard, and it makes your offense easier. And I just kind of thought, like, for a while, basketball sort of lost that whole the idea behind, like, running can be effective and running can be a winning strategy. I think, you know, in the last few years now that we've, you know, gotten the Warriors and 7 seconds or less Suns and the Spurs kind of embracing that and, you know, turning into their own identity, I think we have, you know, a better, faster, more, you know, intricate game with more passing than we did kind of in a more isolation heavy era. And I think it's kind of more resembles kind of the game at its aesthetic peak.
Yeah, it kind of shows, I guess, how everything kind of cycles back eventually. So maybe in 20 years we'll be back to isolation ball.
Not that isolation ball is terrible. You know, it's fun sometimes. Yeah. Like, I like your idea that, like, hey, all these different styles can kind of work and bounce off each other and all that. I just think it's when, you know, the game is bought where every team is kind of doing it that way, and, you know, there's you know, not as much speed, not as much passing. That is less appealing to me.
Yeah, and to me, it was always frustrating watching some of those. Obviously, the 90s, especially, is kind of when that was at its peak. But even after that, and you'd hear people talk about, and certainly, you know, defensive concepts have advanced tremendously, and scouting and everything, the analytics that goes into defense now makes it harder to do certain things. But I always got a little frustrated. Part of it was because I was certainly, as a fan of the Showtime Lakers, very devoted to them, even years later. But when people would say, well, you can never fast break like that in today's game, it just wouldn't happen. And to me, that didn't make much sense, because running as a, you know, and that kind of style of offense, a lot of it is just a mindset and just deciding to do it. You know, you can grab a rebound and just hand it to a guy, and that point guard can walk the ball up. That's a way to play the game, but that's a mindset where if you decide, okay, we are going to run, we're going to be aggressive, we're going to get that rebound and look for an outlet like you would see so often in the 80s or today, finally, where you see that aggressiveness. And it doesn't have to be played, you know, just because defense has advanced. It always frustrated me because I didn't think that it meant you could only walk the ball up and wait for the coach to call a play. I always thought you could still, that there'd be room for that. And certainly the fast break today doesn't look the same as it did in the 80s, because teams, you know, the guys will flare out to the 3-point line or whatever.
Right.
But just playing that pace, and like you said, the passing, and just aesthetically, it's so much more pleasing that it's exciting to see. And I'm glad that whether, you know, D'Antoni's sons deserve some credit for that, where he kind of showed that you could play this way. And obviously today with the Warriors leading the way, but other teams, it's just nice to see that if a team decides to play like that, they could play like that. And it gives me hope that, not to get into the could this team play today or today's team play yesterday, but that a team like the Showtime Lakers would be just fine today, because if you really want to run, you can always run.
Sure, sure. A few more things about Russell and kind of the revolutionary impact that he had. He was the first NBA player to dunk regularly, at least according to Slater Martin, who was a Lakers and Hawks star in the 50s. You know, guys could dunk before that, but it was really kind of the dunk was kind of considered a show-off-y type thing where if you would basically get knocked on your ass later if you were dunking. But it was kind of more accepted for Russell, maybe because his limited arsenal, especially at first, he didn't score many other ways. He did improve in that as his career advanced, although obviously his field goal percentage was notoriously low. And in the NCAA changed the rules for him, first widening the lane, which actually ended up helping him and hurting slower players, but helped him because he he had the speed, you know, kind of negated the issue for that. And then they eventually outlawed offensive goaltending as well. And then Russell, when he first joined the NBA, was accused by the Warriors owner of goaltending and playing a one-man zone, basically just, there's a lot of just fear of change and a lot of we can't let this guy do this to our game or what have you. And there's a lot of, you know, this has to do with a fear and agonizing by a, you know, mostly white basketball culture of the rise of black superstars and Russell really the first black superstar to be in the NBA and to really put his mark on the league and how they shaped the game late in the 50s and into the 60s with, you know, just a completely different style, more of a, you know, open fast break game, which we've talked about. The adding sort of individual flair was no longer taboo, and it was just kind of a freer, looser, changed game. And, you know, obviously, with the African-American superstars that were, you know, that came into the game, like Baylor, Oscar Robertson, Sam Jones, Hal Greer, they all kind of, you know, put like a different kind of template into the game and how they changed the way that the game was played.
Yeah, and I think they deserve the credit, obviously, because I think, you know, going back to when we talk about basketball history, and I'm the same way, I'm not excluding myself here, where I kind of picture basketball history, even though I shouldn't, I picture it starting with, say, the late 50s, early 60s, and that's because I think of Russell, Chamberlain, Baylor, West, Oscar, that they were such dominant forces, such game-changing players, that they really, they didn't invent, you know, modern NBA, but gosh, they deserve so much credit for making the game, you know, bringing it from this league that had started, as we said, wasn't even the NBA in the late 40s, and even through the 50s, and obviously the 50s there, it was primarily, you know, the dominant players, the scoring champions would be, you know, Paul Arizin, Joel Foulkes, like we mentioned, George Yardley, certainly Bob Pettit deserves a lot of credit for also being a revolutionary figure as a big man who shot the jump shot. But it's those, you know, African-American players in the early 60s who really completely revolutionized the game and were so good that they are the guys that, oh yeah, when we think about basketball history, that's kind of, for so many people, at least for myself, that's almost like the starting point, is when those guys were taking over the league.
I mean, that's sort of the easy way to kind of mentally remember the league is starting with the Celtics dynasty. I mean, just because it's the kind of the first big story that has kind of a modern connection to the past, that it just kind of makes the game like understandable. I mean, obviously a lot has changed since the 60s, but you can watch 60s basketball And it's mostly recognizable. Obviously, without the three-pointer, it's different. And you know, there are different skills being established in different levels of athleticism and bodies and a lot of things. But, you know, it's much more recognizable than a game from the early 50s, where it's sometimes it's almost hard to kind of tell what you're watching. So I think it's just something that we have an easier connection with. And you know, there were, you know, better players playing in a style that is more recognizable to what we can see today. I liked that you brought up Sam Jones of the Celtics and Hal Greer of the Nationals and 76ers when they moved. You know, those are two guys who I think are sort of under-discussed in the 60s, but they both were really great players who happened to kind of play behind Jerry West and Oscar Robertson, two of the premier guards, obviously, of all time and of their era. You know, what did you kind of learn about them and find interesting about them?
Yeah, they were a lot of fun to write about because, like you said, they were the all NBA players of the 60s from the guards. It was going to be Oscar and West, and Jones and Greer were, you know, a step below them. And Red Auerbach, he talked about how when he was talking about Sam Jones, he said, you know, Jones isn't, he's not Jerry West and Oscar Robertson. His all around game, certain aspects, he wasn't at their level, but as far as shooting, Red said he would take him, you know, against anyone. And both of those guys were so instrumental to their teams. And Jones, of course, obviously, and that's kind of what I write about, is how that decade, so defined by Wilt and Russell, and then, you know, the two guys that just dominated the league, and from 57 through 73, even, it's one of those guys, or it's Kareem with the Bucks. It's a big guy winning the title. And the exception, but the difference was, so many times you had a jump shot that kind of played a huge role, and so many times it was Sam Jones. 69, game four, with the Celtics trailing 2-1, about to go down 3-1, and he hits the shot at the buzzer to win it. He hit the winning shot in the 62 series against, you know, tormented Wilt to send him into the finals. And then a missed shot by Frank Selvey, of course, in game seven of the 1962 finals, that if he hits, the Lakers win, and kind of changes history in a lot of ways. So he had a jump shot changing so many things in that decade. And Jones was so often just, obviously, in game sevens was when he kind of made his mark, especially. And even in 1969, it was fascinating reading about, the Celtics were obviously on their last legs. Russell and Sam Jones, especially, that was their final season. And they both, from every account that you read, they were playing like old guys. You know, they were really just struggling to get through the season.
Sure.
And Sam Jones had quotes during the regular season where he was kind of upset with the Celtics, you know, rushing him back from an injury. He had leg injuries. He couldn't move like he could, you know, used to. But they were just trying to get to those finals. And then once they did, they again somehow pulled it out. And he was really unappreciated. Even, it took him way too long to get in the Hall of Fame. It took into the mid-80s. And Bob Ryan wrote a column in around 1980 asking, you know, why is Sam Jones not in the Hall of Fame? And Hal Greer was in the same boat. It took him way too long to get in the Hall of Fame after he retired. You know, his career unfortunately ended with the horrific 76ers team that won 9 games. But throughout that decade, he was so consistent. I think that's the word that you just always read so often, that from 15 feet, he was always going to knock in a shot. He shot his free throws with a jump shot, so the jumper was really a part of his game.
I love that.
And then when Wilt, of course, won his first title with the Sixers, Greer led the team in scoring in the playoffs, and obviously Wilt was the dominant force, but Greer was such an underrated part of that team, and it was fun writing about them because with so many big figures that we talked about and personalities, Wilt, Russell, but then also Oscar and West, that those two really do, I think, get lost to history. So it was fun writing about them and just how their games and the jump shots not only affected their careers, but also basketball history.
Yeah. To me, like, if you want to kind of make modern analogs for Jones and Greer, I always, for Jones, I always kind of think Manu Ginobili, and for Greer, for Tony Parker. Like, I feel like as far as kind of skill level and roles, not necessarily how they played, but Jones was this, this great shooting guard who, you know, matched up with anybody, but kind of played limited minutes and stepped up in big moments but wasn't the day-to-day superstar. And Greer was kind of, you know, more just, you know, more steady, more, you know, hit, just, you know, picked his spots. Again, not quite like an elite player, but a, you know, very good player who was a, you know, a key cog and even carried it sometimes. You know, very good teams. I kind of feel like those are, you know, if you're a modern fan and never heard of, you know, or doesn't know much about either guy, I feel like those are decent parallels, modern parallels that you can be like, you know, that's kind of where they were in the NBA during their time.
And of course, Sam Jones, the famous bank shot. Yes. That's what, even if people didn't know a lot about his career, that's what you'd hear about it. It was interesting reading old stories about him where he would talk about his bank shot. And you know, that's something that a lot of times you'll hear again, old timers, you know, no one's got the bank shot. No one shoots it like Sam Jones used to, even though guys like Duncan, Wade, Pippen used it very sure. effectively. Kobe did. But the interesting thing to me was reading stories from back then that said, well, no one was doing it before him really either, or as he was playing. It's not like it was a golden era of guys shooting off the glass. It was something that Sam Jones was great at and set him apart during his time. And then also in the decades afterwards, it was so effective that people kind of call it a, you know, a Sam Jones bank shot. It became an adjective, but it wasn't something like the, you know, the bank shot kind of died when, you know, if you will, when he left. But it's not like it was this golden shot before that. He was really revolutionary with that shot, which Red Auerbach also talked about. Although interestingly, when I had a chance to talk to Bob Ryan, he said Rudy Tomjanovich had the best bank shot from long distance that he'd ever seen, even much better than Jones. But Jones from anywhere else on the court was just so effective with that shot.
Sure. Yeah, that's interesting. That's neat. Is there, you know, in doing your doing all the research you did for the book and looking at, you know, all the players that you did, are there any that just really like stood out and were like, wow, this is just amazing, or this is really fascinating, or something that really stands out of, you know, any player that you kind of looked at in all the different eras you checked out?
There's different stories. You know, some of the stories that I enjoyed the most were players that, you know, we haven't heard, or especially, you know, I didn't know a lot before I started. And one name that really stands out to me in the book was Travis Grant. Had a very brief NBA career, 4 or 5 seasons, was drafted by the champion Lakers in 72, but really didn't play much with them. And then had a couple of good years in the ABA with Wilt actually as his coach, but his college career was absolutely amazing at NAIA Kentucky State. Won 3 straight national titles. And when he left school, he was the all-time leading scorer in all of college basketball, whether it was NCAA or NAIA. He had scored more than Pistol Pete. And everyone talked about every story. They called his nickname was the Machine, and a lot of it was because of his jump shot. They said from, say, 18 feet, he was just automatic. And he never shot below 60% in all his 4 seasons that he played, which is a remarkable stat. He shot over 70% one season. So reading a story about him, and he was one of those guys that during that era of the 70s where they would shoot 40 times a game, but he kind of set himself apart by hitting a high percentage. So he's someone that really stood out to me as someone whose story I didn't, you know, necessarily know. And then I really, you know, I enjoyed writing about the guys in the 80s, the great small forwards who didn't use a 3-pointer, even though they could have, the line was there. But Bernard King, Alex English, Mark Aguirre, Purvis Short and his rainbow jumper. It was really fun reading about those guys, watching old clips and talking to some of them. So it was a lot of the guys who aren't necessarily the superstars, although I write a lot about them. You know, I have a chapter about Bird, but it was some of those guys who maybe people don't know about as much that I really enjoyed writing about.
So yeah, another guy that I found really interesting was Frank Selvey, who, you know, I really all I knew was, you know, he missed the shot in the 62 finals for the Lakers. But, you know, he was the I believe the first to score 100 points in a NCAA game, making the final shot near midcourt at the buzzer. And, you know, was on his way to a pretty good NBA career before I believe an injury struck.
Yeah, he was. Like you said, unfortunately, he's kind of known even today as the guy who missed the shot that could have changed basketball history in 1962. But he was the first player to average, no one averaged 30 before, and then he averaged over 40 in college. Bob Pettit averaged 30 that same season. So he really, with his shot, was really ahead of his time in the college game. Goes into the NBA, has a really good rookie year. Newspapers are talking about how, you know, this great shooter that's coming to the league. And then, unfortunately, a series of injuries. And then he missed several seasons because he was called into the service. Again, one of those things that when we consider basketball history, comparing it today is so hard because guys aren't losing 2 years in their prime to go serve in the military. And he comes back, and he also said he got injured during his time in the service, knee injuries. And a story in this, I believe, is the Sporting News talked about how Frank Selvey had lost his jump shot because his knees, and he had lost, you know, the ability to use his legs in a shot. And once Selvey kind of lost his great jump shot, he was no longer going to be a superstar, unfortunately, but still had a very, very nice career as a role player, but is one of those kind of what-if players where if he doesn't get hurt, you know, he might have been one of the really great shooters of the 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's always a thin margin, you know, it's like, you know, from being, you know, one of the greats to, or, you know, being very good to being pretty good at least, you know, it just takes a little bit of a slip of, you know, athleticism or something going on. It can really, you know, change the course of someone's career in the course of NBA history. And that's, I guess,
Elgin Baylor, another one, obviously he had a tremendous career, but everyone still talks about it. How unfortunate it was that his leg injuries kind of robbed him in the latter stage of his career of just took away. He would have been even better, which is hard to fathom.
But. Right. Yeah. And how hard he had to work to kind of overcome the knee injuries just to be able to, you know, play effectively in the second half of his career. I mean, he, you know, looked for a while he was done. I mean, he really like worked through and worked hard and strengthened that knee, and it, you know, it was not responding well. It was looking like he might be done. He had a you know, rough few months, and then was able to kind of come through and, you know, and still achieve a lot in the you know, last 4 or 5 years, you know, before he started to really break down in the early 70s. So yeah, I mean, that makes a big difference too, but even to accomplish what he did was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, and there's, I think it was you that tweeted, or you guys, your account, it was a number I hadn't really thought about before. It was just fascinating to me, the number of, was it players who played over the age of like 36 or 7?
Yes.
And from the, you know, how, what that number was, say, in the 80s, even in the 90s, and then what it is today. And that was just eye-opening to me. And I guess I should have known that and kind of knew it on some level, but had never really thought of it so concretely or seen it in that. And that really, I think also when we're talking about basketball history, is another thing you have to take into consideration with those guys from back then, that their careers were, they weren't going to be playing, certainly not effectively, even playing at all into their late 30s. So they had very short time frame to get things done.
Yeah, and obviously they're also starting their career later because, you know, one until the 70s is leaving early from college. So, it just completely narrows that window for a lot of players, with, you know, with rare exceptions being able to play, you know, more than 12, 13 years. Almost no one did up until the late 70s and into the 80s. And then, yeah, once the 90s and especially in the 2000s, now it's much more common.
And it is, you know, there's a great story a couple months ago, I think it was ESPN.com, about travel in today's NBA, and it's still obviously a very grueling thing just because the human body traveling that amount takes such a toll. But it is, it kind of makes those numbers from back then even more incredible when you see whether it's Wilt, Russell, Oscar, these guys playing 45, you know, obviously Wilt famously, but even the other guys were averaging 44 minutes and playing 80 games a season. And when you consider what their travel was back then, it's again, which makes it so hard to compare eras because it's just two completely different worlds.
Yeah. And they're playing, you know, back to back to backs. You know, it's a more compressed schedule. And, you know, hey, they're playing a faster pace, which I think is harder to do. I mean, it requires more energy. It requires, it's more physically enduring to play faster, I think, for, you know, an entire game than it is to, than it is to, you know, play even a modern, you know, faster pace than it was in the 90s is still, you know, less taxing, I think, overall. Now, you know, maybe you're giving up some of that on the defensive end. So maybe, you know, it's closer overall than we think. But still, I mean, that's, you know, I think that is and that's something as well.
And that, you know, talking about the different eras, and you might have already discussed this with the Russell talk, but I was just thinking about it today with, you know, you'll still hear people say winning 8 in a row, winning 11. Well, it was easier back then because there were so few teams. There's 8-9 teams in the league. And, you know, when I was a kid, like I said, as a Lakers fan, as I wanted to denigrate Celtics history, I think I had that argument too. Like, well, you know, that it was a different league. That would never happen today. But I was thinking of it today and, gosh, think if there were 8 teams in the league today and we had the Warriors like they are, you had the Spurs like they are, but say Duncan's in his prime on the Spurs team. You have Oklahoma City with Durant and Westbrook. The East, you have LeBron and that Cavs team. To me, I can't picture every year, you know, Golden State and San Antonio are going to face each other. The idea of one of those teams winning 8 titles in a row is even harder to picture because not that the Warriors, quote unquote, got lucky, Doc Rivers last year, but the fact was, you know, they didn't have to face the Spurs or, you know, Thunder like that. Where it's a smaller league, you're going to have to face that other super team. And that, to me, it really put into, you know, just painted a picture of, not that I didn't consider it impressive before, but when I was thinking of a team today in an 8-team league, winning 8 in a row, winning 11 in 13 years, I can't picture any team from today being able to pull that off. So to me, that just shows how impressive it was back then. I don't think the fact that it was a smaller league takes away from what they did. You know, as I've kind of gotten older and more appreciative maybe of that era, it makes it even more impressive to me. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I hadn't really kind of considered it in that way. But, I mean, yeah, it's just hard to imagine compressing the talent we have in the NBA now into 8 teams and what incredible teams those would be. But then again, like what you know, certain players wouldn't have the freedom of opportunity that they have. They wouldn't have Jimmy Butler probably wouldn't become a superstar if, you know, he's drafted into an 8-team league because he's behind, you know, he's the fifth guard on that team. And he probably doesn't get the shots that he has if he's, you know, in the league that he's in now. So there's so many things to kind of consider with that. But I think that's absolutely true. I mean, it's harder to dodge a team that's just a really tough matchup or, you know, a really elite team that matches up with you because, you know, it's a smaller league. It's just harder to avoid that. It's if the teams happen to be stocked in one conference, or, you know, it can happen. But there's a reason why the Celtics were going through the Lakers or going through Wilt pretty much every year, and those were generally the best teams that they had to play, or the Hawks early on in their in that run. I mean, that's, you know, they were.
And today, one thing, obviously, you know, they'll say, well, you have to play more seriously, and that's true, but how often in the NBA do you really see, and how many first-round huge upsets? It just really doesn't happen. It's always, that's the thing with the best of 7 or best of, even in the best of 5 years, you didn't see it a lot where it is the best team wins. So even if those Celtics teams, you know, would have had to play an extra round, I don't know. I wouldn't have seen them being upset in an earlier round, so I don't know if that extra first round especially carries much more weight, because most of the championship teams, the 07 Mavericks being an obvious exception, but if you're a great team, you're just not losing in the first round.
Yeah, it's certainly harder. It is such a it's a different environment. It's hard to compare, but I think you definitely bring up some very good points there. So before we go, anything else you'd like to talk about?
No, I mean, just it's great that you're doing this on Russell because, you know, obviously he's not going to say unappreciated, because I think everyone does appreciate what he is and does. But I think sometimes, whether it is the 8 titles in a row whether people talking about his offensive skills not being, you know, he wasn't Hakeem Olajuwon on the offensive end or anything, it can kind of maybe overshadow the greatness that he was, whether it was defensively or just how ahead of his time he was with leaving the court and his basketball genius. So I just think it's great to have this discussion about someone that there's not, you know, it's, as the years go by, there's going to be fewer and fewer of us who have the chance to see him play live. So it's great that he'll still be, and all those guys from that era, of course, but someone who was so dominant that he's still vital today and still in the discussion.
Yeah, and I think part of our goal for this is to obviously, you know, explore why he's great. I mean, everyone knows that he's great, but to explore the kind of the reasons why, you know, he was so effective, just how trend-setting and game-changing he really was beyond the greatness, and then also kind of get to know him better as a personality and as a man. Because, you know, we tend to look back at the legends and we, you know, it's impossible to know everything about anyone, you know, or, you know, a lot about anyone unless you really study. And there's so many subjects to study that it's hard to, you know, you just kind of get that base knowledge. And he's like this, you know, he'd be one of the four people on NBA's Mount Rushmore. So to kind of take him from being, you know, this statue that, you know, that with all this glory is heaped upon, you know, which he deserves, but to go beyond that and to just kind of see the, you know, the depth of who he was and what he meant to the league and how the league changed because of him and because of the Celtics, I think that's all definitely ripe for exploration. So we're happy to do it. We're glad people are listening. We're very glad to have you and other really smart people come join us and to explore the game and the rich history of the game. It's a lot of fun for us.
Yeah, like you said, his on-court part is just one facet of why he was so important and so fascinating, too, because the off-the-court was, you know, just as vital. So it's just great to explore that as well.
Definitely. So, all right, well, so where can people get your book?
Any of their local bookstore, whether it's a Barnes & Noble or Books A Million or their local independent bookstore, hopefully carries it or will carry it if you ask them, and then certainly online, whether it's Amazon or Barnes & Noble's website, other online retailers should have it available.
Yes, and for those who have forgotten, it's called Rise and Fire, and John Fury is the author. You should definitely check it out. Thank you, Sean, again for being on the show.
And thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. We greatly appreciate it. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Over and Back NBA. You can find our show at HarvardParoxysm.com. We're part of the HP network of podcasts. You can find Over and Back both on iTunes and on Stitcher. We would greatly appreciate a rating and review, preferably a good one. And until next time, thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.